Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, back on the East Coast from the California Majnoon Endogenous Indigenuity Tour. I'm still crafting and brewing that material, and we are just now past the new moon, unusual hybrid solar eclipse. It was annular, partial, then total, then annular, then partial. Not in our part of the world, but still, you know, an eclipse. What would we like to be eclipsed? And then we emerge into Earth Day. So we are welcoming John Perlin, whose prodigious A Forest Journey has just been republished by Patagonia. Retaining our forests, he says, can help resolve climate crisis, protect the integrity of many of our streams and rivers, and continue to provide food and shelter for much of the world's land animals, says Perlin, author of 4 books and former physics professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. It is my hope, he says, that this new edition of A Forest Journey will make clear the imperative humanity faces, because losing our forests would not merely be the end of nature, it could mean the end of us. It has been chosen of one of Harvard's 100 great books. John Perlin is the author of 4 books, A Golden Thread, 2,500 Years of Solar Architecture and Technology, A Forest Journey, here we are, From Space to Earth, The Story of Solar Electricity, and Let It Shine, The 600-Year Story of Solar Energy. He taught physics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The website is patagonia.com/A Forest Journey. And go to the notes section there on that website for teaching guide. For truly, this dedicated work should be included in all curriculums in our ongoing task of becoming good Earth steward citizens, as opposed to rogue, ill-mannered species, and answering Antonio Machado's query, what have we done with the garden entrusted to us? So in this new edition, Perlin cites data on how humanity has cut down half the trees on the planet in the last 12,000 years, and that deforestation continues at an alarming pace, with 15 billion trees removed per year. That's 500,000 square miles of forested land lost since the first 1989 edition of A Forest Journey. So he says, old-growth forest systems now and in the future take on equally significant roles as they did in the past. This time, it is their protection rather than extraction that will allow civilization to flourish. So welcome, fellow Libran cultural agent on behalf of nature, John Perlin.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Let's get to it.
Thank you. Yeah, so appreciating so much, right from the get-go, you guide us into your nuanced perspective on John Muir, going, no one is one thing. He did some terrible things and some great things. So we throughout the whole work, we appreciate your nuanced perspective.
Well, John Muir is an interesting story because I mentioned in the book, this were Victorian America, he would be condemned for making love to his host's younger wife on his first visit to Yosemite. But now that we have cancel people, I don't know where people get the idea that John Muir was a bigot. Basically, the one thing John Muir did was he loved Yosemite, and anybody who got in the way of Yosemite, which were mostly white people who wanted to mine or wanted to cut down trees, he'd be bitter and angry and fight.
Yes,
he was not a person who hated humanity, as some people paint him. In fact, he saved a baby in Alaska from First Nation because the First Nation mother died and the little baby didn't have milk, and so he ran to his canoe to get all his condensed milk and nursed the baby to health, for example.
Yes. No, nuance. Nuance is part of what we want to include in our restore to our human repertoire. And then, you know, you can go anywhere you want. I will aspire to proffer, you know, prompts, but go anywhere you want at any time. But I was admiring of the frame of your book, starting from, you know, the stories really of Gilgamesh and Enkidu and Humbaba's curse, which you also end with. Maybe you could just bring that up for the moment from Mesopotamian mythology.
Right. Well, Gilgamesh was the allegedly the first ruler of the city of Uruk in southern Mesopotamia. And Uruk was the first, you might say, foothold of civilization. And Gilgamesh was, you know, a virally male, a superman. The very embodiment of civilization was gung-ho on conquering and destroying what previously had been set aside for the gods. And the gods set aside the forest because, as you can imagine, in the very hot Middle East, the forests were just the opposite. They were like heaven on earth. They provided shade, they provided water, they provided beautiful songs by the birds and the screeching of, monkeys. And, you know, who could believe that in the mountains of Mesopotamia today, which are treeless, that once they were as great as the Pacific Northwest? And so Gilgamesh was warned not to venture into the wilderness by the older people, and he very manly said, "I will fell the great forest," and which has become the mantra of society ever since, mercilessly chopping down forest after forest. And as Gilgamesh threatened before he took his forest journey, "I shall cut off the head of Humbaba, who was put there by the gods to keep their heaven on earth free from humans." And then once he killed Humbaba, his plan was to chop down all the cedars to build the great city of Uruk so his name would endure forever and forever. And I asked the question, is not this the quest of every civilization and its rulers?
Yes, no, you weave that wonderfully from beginning to the end, which we will honor the very ending of your book, which is so powerful. And then, you know, it's really an invitation for us all to decondition from our cultural narratives, right? Everything into the cauldron, and what are our vetting standards for ladling things out? So you also, because I had studied the Mahabharata and Indian civilization, but I'd somehow forgotten how cruel it is. You know, the speciesism, the cruelty really celebrates our rogue species cruelty. You have the cunning of the animals thwarted the Pandavas by preventing Agni, the god of fire, from burning down the forest. But the Pandavas prevailed, right? And that's sort of celebrated.
Well, actually, the fire. All the founding myths and in the book of China, of India, of Mesopotamia, all celebrate the war against the forests. For example, in China, the founding King Yao, he looked at the wilderness and was appalled how messy the wilderness is. You know, birds screaming and screeching, all these critters like, you know, running around, you know, tigers growling. And so what he did was he tasked his forester, chief forester, to burn down the entire forest in China and produce orderly rice paddies. So that's the founding legend of China. And the founding legend in the Mahabharata is that the Agni complained to his father that, or his grandfather, I have to look that up, but to people, you know, to powers above him, that he's been thwarted to burn down the forest. And so the gods give him like a total free reign to destroy the, it's called the Kandava forest. So the let's see, let me look. It's to be really accurate. So for the people to form a you know arable land, and so what happens is all the great gods, like for example Arjun and others, were so emboldened, you know, and that as the animals tried to flee the forest, they would kill all the escaping animals to civilize the what we call India.
Right. So we're really called upon to. Oh yeah.
We're called upon, like, to kill the trees and kill the animals, so we can civilize and have control over the land.
Right.
But what's interesting, you know, what's interesting is in the Old Testament, the first command that God gives to Adam is to protect the trees.
Right.
And right. I could say it in Hebrew as Shomer HaAtzim, which means literally almost militarily defend the forest.
We like so that one. We ladle that out of the cauldron, and then in keeping with your guiding us to nuance, we go sort of out of horror comes redemption on occasion. So China, complex then, complex now. But one of the best things I went to at the Bioneers Conference, it's 2 weeks now, was Kim Stanley Robinson, and talking about how he's grown more hopeful since he wrote The Ministry for the Future. And part of it is China, right, complex thing. But China has come up with, in keeping with E.O. Wilson, 30 by 30 by 30, 30% of the world to be wild, 30% cultured by 2030. And then they go, and then we'll do 50 by 50 by 50, 50% of the world wild and untouched, 50% human habitation by 2050. It's like, okay, all right, out of China, which is also destroying things at the same time, but we like that idea. Do you love E.O. Wilson's plan and that idea that's being picked up, you know, in unlikely places?
Well, China is actually for thousands of years was the paradigm for deforestation. In fact, Mencius, who was the philosopher of the 3rd century BC, he talked about the mountain called Nu, which he said he used it to explain what is actual and what is proverbial. And he said a mountain is proverbially full of trees, but because we chopped down all the trees on the mountain and then let the animals graze on the saplings, it's not really a mountain. So and then under Mao Zedong, with the Great Leap Forward, the peasants destroyed all the trees to fuel their back, foundries for iron, and deforested much of China. In that, reflecting on the founding legend. And today what China does, it reforests by deforesting Africa. And so so what they do is they export, I call it exporting deforestation. In China they've been planting, but one of the scenes in contemporary Africa is you see Chinese boats docked by, say, like Liberia, like 20 years ago, and they would exchange guns with a ruthless dictator for timber.
Yeah, yeah. Right. No,
so that's where we have to be careful, is a country could have really good domestic policies, but have very detrimental foreign policies. So we don't want to either export deforestation, and we don't want to, you know, deforest our remaining forests in countries like China and the U.S.
Yes. Thank you. A good, terrible guide as well. And then they're trying to do the 30 by 30 by 30. Okay, we look at, you know, the complexity, and it's good. You know, it's like we got to know how horrible it is, and you're really good at that. You know, it's,
yes, so
it's grim.
What happened in China was the land lost its cover, and so you had the erosive forces of the earth, sun, water, and wind, blowing the deforested land, the deforested soil, into Beijing, creating a terrible, you know, pollution. And so this is one of the, I guess you would call it one of the incentives to clean up this mess. And so what we find is because of all this destructiveness over the thousands of years, we have a lot of cleanup to do.
Right. Well, the ongoing, you know, curse of Humbaba, going, that's the guardian protector of the forest and the cedar forests. And you do, you know, delineate in this prodigious work. Again, I want to encourage everyone as part of our essential curriculum and teaching, and it's a deep and generous work, and all praise to Patagonia for putting in teaching notes and everything at the end that you can find, everyone. I encourage everyone to go to patagonia.com/aforestjourney and go to the notes section for a teaching guide. And we go,
they can go to my new website called aforestjourney.com.
Oh, good.
Which creates an entire landscape of the new book. And I'd like to tell your listeners that this is not a rehash of the older edition. It's 160 more pages with all the research that has shown that how integral forests are for our survival that has accumulated since the book was first published in 1989.
Right. You guide us through the horrific history, which we got to know, and then of course you come up into the, you know, what sane, reverent common sense, all science is saying is that viral storms are unleashed by the destruction of habitat. You know, that's just how it is, right? When people say, when will the pandemic end? And it's like, it will end when humans quit despoiling the earth and the habitat of
our creatures. Well, actually, that's a good point you bring up, because in one part of the new edition, I talk about human health and the integrity of the forests, and we find that that there are multiple lethal diseases which have been caused by deforestation. For example, Lyme disease in the east coast of America is a result of fragmentation of the forest for building houses, and the consequence is that the specialized species, which are predators, with the forest, they were able to keep down the generalized species, which were the rats, the mice. And once the predators were dead, the mice proliferated, and their
ticks.
The larvae, the ticks, find the mice as an incredible incubator. And so,
right.
And so also, what really stimulated me as I worked on the new edition of A Forest Journey over the last 5 years was in 2018, I ran across a scientific article called Bats, Deforestation, and Coronaviruses. 2 years before,
yeah,
you know, the pandemic hit.
Right. There's also a great book called Spillover by David Quammen about, again, before the pandemic hit, about this is what's coming. And again, all virologists as detectives, and it's not the bat's fault. They're just, you know, disturbed, right? We removed boundaries. We removed boundaries and manners, right, which has unleashed these viral storms, right? And you do mention, yeah, the Lyme disease is important. And the as you say, the forest, the decimation, right? And then it's not deer that are the primary carriers, as you point out. It's the white mouse, which carries the ticks. And so it really is, you know, over and over again, but we want to delve into it. You know, where humans mess things up, it messes humans up. You know, whatever we do to the Lord.
Absorbed into my mind as I did the new edition was how fragile and the various connections of the earth are. And once we mess with one part, the other parts get shattered also.
Yeah.
So, for example, you take the bats, for example, kept in check by the predators, we have what we might call social distancing. But once we remove the forest, the bats proliferate because the farms have lighting. They attract insects, which is the bats' favorite food, right? And so bats become the dominant species, and the bats they've made peace with the coronavirus evolutionarily, but their droppings create the infectious, the viral, you might say, route to humanity. And I might add that if you can actually trace the spread of coronavirus with the air routes of the world.
I'm sorry, with the what of the world?
The air routes, you know, of the world, you know, because people would be incubating coronavirus, and in 12 hours they would be in, say, a whole nother place where they could also spread the disease.
Yeah. No, it's again, nuance, complexity, as you say, fragile, complex boundaries, and over again, you know, you delineate our species crossing boundaries without even understanding what they're doing, right? Without even understanding why they're there or for what, or that they're there, right? You mentioned malaria as deforestation.
Oh, malaria also. Well. I mean, malaria is, actually, some investigators from my university said the spread of malaria is how deforestation bites.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Right. And again, as you say, you know, it's the disruption of complex equilibrium and human galumphiness going, we'll just conquer and eat this and tear it down. Because, yeah, what they delineate, the viral detectives in Spillover, they go to Australia to examine a particularly virulent virus. This is long before the pandemic, you know, and they go, yes. And then they, what you suggest, they say, well, this virus has been in the bats for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. You know,
millions of years.
What changed? Oh, millions. Thank you. Millions of years. What changed? And then they go,
What changed was the removal of the social distancing that the trees provided, and also the culling of the bat populations by the predators that the forest provided. In fact, what's really fascinating is, for example, in Africa, the disease called Ebola can be traced to the deforesting of the big trees of Africa.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed was just before I came on, they were announcing that history is basically how the present powers present. And what I found fascinating was Humbaba, who was the protector of the forest in the Epic of Gilgamesh, he was looked by the indigenous people as a god, and he was mm-hmm. looked by Gilgamesh, who was trying to destroy the forest, as the devil.
Right. Right.
So I found that introduction really fascinating because it depends on one's perspective.
Yeah, no, that's why we want to be as investigative and suspicious, creatively, warily suspicious of all narratives as they come to us. Yeah, Humbaba then depicted as a kind of Gorgon. It's like, no, the protector. You know, it's like in Bali when the U.S.-backed death squads were sweeping through the villages, you know, killing farmers, the killers wore the masks of the forest gods, right, as a particularly cruel, horrific appropriation, right? So, yeah, again, who has the story? Who has the symbols, you know, and to restore them? You know, they wore the masks of the forest protector gods, right? And so
this is why I say, the Epic of Gilgamesh is basically the paradigm of what has happened ever since civilization began. The reason why civilization destroyed the forest was not just vandalism, was because, for example, Gilgamesh wanted to build a great city, right? And he needed the timber to make his temples to leave a name for himself. And the same thing was done by Solomon, which is really interesting because the temple he built came from the cedars of Lebanon, and it was built on where the, I believe it's the Olisk, or Temple of the Mount Mosque is, and it, you know, continues, right, to this day.
Right.
I'd also like to talk about, in Gilgamesh, Enkidu. Because Enkidu is an interesting character because he was made by the gods to protect against the inroads of civilization and to destroy all the traps that the pioneers, you might say, or the settlers outside of Uruk were developing. And then, due to various events, he became a friend of Gilgamesh. But then, in what's called the ecological Gilgamesh, as they're sailing down the Tigris River with all the logs that they destroyed the forest with, Enkidu turns to Gilgamesh and he said, "I think we've turned the great forest into a wasteland. What will we tell our gods? How will we explain this vandalism?" And I think that's amazing because here we have born 5,000 years ago the first environmental ethic ever presented in history. And what makes the legend, or you might say the Epic of Gilgamesh, so real is that currently archaeologists are now finding elephant remains all over the Middle East. There's not a single, you know, elephant that exists in that area today. And so what they did was they, by cutting down the cedar forest, they removed the habitat of the elephant, which led to its extinction in that part of the world.
Yes. We're going to explore more grim necessary facts and redemption after our very short break in a moment. Our perfect for now, completely prepared for this moment in history, ally John Perlin, author of A Forest Journey. His website is aforestjourney.com, and we'll be back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tallest cry.
Oh, get down.
She chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and we are all together hosting our perfect for, well, now backwards and forwards, guest John Perlin, whose prodigious work, A Forest Journey, has just been republished by Patagonia, a wonderfully ethical company. All praise be upon them. His website is aforestjourney.com, and do go there. This is essential for if we want to be citizens of the Earth, right? Here we are on the eve-ish of Earth Day. It may be Earth Year, may it be Earth Century. So yes, wherever we want to, you know, the ecological Gilgamesh is where you were just then, and how we want to explore the stories that we've honored, like the Mahabharata, which is really about devastation, and then we pick up your narrative about the cutting down of forests, really for war. Well, for cities and glorification and temples and stuff, but for war. And then there's so much rich. I like. We all love learning things we didn't know. There's a lot.
What happened in the Middle East was after they cut down the forests on the mountaintops, the mountaintops contained soil that was rich in salt, and so all the salt poured down to Mesopotamia and eventually destroyed all the great civilizations, because the salinization creates a total impediment on agriculture.
Right.
So who, you know, Gilgamesh didn't think, once again, just like today, Gilgamesh didn't think, oh, if I cut down these trees, we're going to lose all our crops, right?
Right. No, repercussions, investigation, honoring complexity, not being galumphy, which our rogue species is, but there are good people like yourself working on redemption. Right, so there's a great delineation, and periodically you come up with, you know, Aristotle wanted to create laws to protect nature, right? Do you want to just do a little honor to Aristotle's attempt?
Well, actually, Plato brought Aristotle's attention to the problem where he was looking in the mountains where still some trees remained. But downstream, he saw all the devastation, and as a consequence, he wrote, "There's no more soil left on the Athenian earth, and the remains look just like the bones of an animal without any meat left."
Yeah.
Also, I'd like to tell the audience, the book begins with the first true tree, which grew about 360 million years ago, and it began the great carbon dioxide takedown and the great addition of oxygen into the atmosphere, which created, you might say, an Eden on Earth, where... Mm-hmm. Large animals could, survive, which include us.
Yeah.
I actually went digging, and I have, fossils of that first true tree.
Oh. And where is the first true tree?
Well, actually, we have to think that back in like 370, 380 million years ago, there was just one great continent called Gondwanaland.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tree, because there was no separation of continents, the tree could spread throughout Gondwanaland. So as the tectonic plates broke up Gondwanaland into the various continents, we now have fossilized remains in various places throughout the world, including where I went, which was in western Pennsylvania, but also it's found in the Catskills in New York, northern New York, and it's also found in southern Morocco. It's also found in Spitsbergen, which is a large island off Norway above the Arctic Circle. So we have remains of that tree all over the place because of the fact that it grew on the supercontinent that later would be broken up.
And you make the comparison to the planet Venus that everyone thought, well, it's very much like Earth, isn't it? There we go. It's like, you know, until they saw not, right?
Well, that's a very interesting example of the beauty of being able to measure things, because in the 19th century, people looked in their telescopes and saw all these clouds on Venus, so they just assumed that the clouds were rain clouds and creating, you know, a tropical paradise. But then when in 1970s, when the first satellites, the first probes, I should say, came to Venus, we learned just the opposite, that it was a runaway greenhouse disaster. And the only reason why the Earth has not happened as Venus did is because much of that carbon is sequestered in the geology of the Earth. And much of that was a consequence of the first true tree called Archaeopteryx and its successors, which we call pine trees and angiosperms today. In fact, coal is mostly just buried trees. And what happens is as the pressure of the Earth hits these trees deep down in the bowels of the earth, the moisture of the tree is removed, so just have pure carbon. And this has been intelligently sequestered and kept underground by nature, but we as Gondwanaland fools opened up a Pandora's box by calling it a treasure and scooping it up, you know, to power the earth. The human industries throughout the globe.
Right. I don't know if you. Go.
I was just going to say the first evidence of the coal is found in the first the remains of the first true tree, which is called Archaeopteryx.
And then this may be outside your usual ken, but when you were born, the sun in Libra, each degree has a metaphor. And when you were born, the metaphor is coal miners emerging from the mine into sunlight. So you're doing your job, lad.
I love it because my other books are on the story of solar energy, how the various technologies emerged, and how photovoltaics, which is now there's over a terawatt of photovoltaics, emerged.
Right.
That's another story. It's a fascinating story of how, once again, Gondwanaland humans will make the wrong turn instead of at the same time that the first practical solar cells were developed, the world was gung-ho on nuclear power.
Right.
So that's another story which is covered in my book, Let It Shine, the 6,000-year story of solar energy. And that paperback was just released a year ago.
Good. That's excellent. You're a prodigious contributor to essential guiding right now, because you also, in this book, A Forest Journey, you also go into solar energy in ancient Rome.
Oh, well, not only ancient Rome, but also in ancient China and ancient Greece. And this is actually what got me started in my research and writing the book, was that as I was writing the history of solar energy, I discovered that as people, the reason people changed to solar in their architecture back then was because they were running out of wood fuel. And so I hypothesized that if running out of wood could be of such existential significance, wood must have played a large role in the history of the world. And then I sat down and started to look at that question, and it took it's taken 30, 40 years of my life to finally get the ultimate story of humanity and its forests.
Right, right. And as you do so well, all great stories lead us to all great stories. You delineate the devastation everywhere, and then the sugar mills, the sweet inferno, slavery, sugar, slavery, all connected to D4. I mean, it is all connected, and the crucial moment where sugar...
when you consider, here's how forest deforestation and slavery are interconnected in multiple ways. First of all, in Africa, unlike racist ideas, Africa was deep in the Iron Age when the slave seekers came to Africa. But the Africans were very happy to trade people for iron, because in a lot of places in Africa by that time, they had deforested by burning, smelting the iron with wood fuel. And so their power rested on iron. So they asked themselves, well, the Europeans came with iron, so they, it worked out that they would trade humans to keep the status quo powerful in Africa. So that was one part. And then also the second part is the forest created the fertile ground to grow sugar. And, people wanted white sugar just like people would run to cocaine today. And so great fortunes were available if you cut down the trees to fuel the manufacture of sugar and then export it to Europe. And so, once again, the only way to do that was, of course, to have slaves.
I want to come right back to that too, but just to interject, Perry Henzel, wonderful Jamaican writer, wrote a great novel called Cain, in which sugar is the protagonist, and it weaves well with your narrative about how it's all one thing. But yes, feel free. Yeah, sugar, coffee, and clocks all come in at the same time, and as industrialism and humans are forced away from the land, and I mean all of these things are part of the the rich narrative that you're proffering and weaving. The sweet inferno,
what I'd like to add is the whole idea of liberal capitalism, where everything was how things looked on an accounting book, but not how things looked on the real earth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is, again, sugar, coffee, and clocks, right? Before that, again, and removal from the land and from intimacy. It's all, well, these are all, what you're proffering, where are these forks in the road that we want, how did we get here? That's really, what you're, and what shall we do?
Actually, I really love this conversation, because you're telling people exactly what the book is all about, is how did we get to a current crisis?
Yes. There's nothing more important. How did we get here? And what shall we do? my colleague Sean Patrick O'Donohue will be starting a course on plants and planets, but in May. But I love his material going. Notice in history, coffee, sugar, and clocks come in at the same time, and then just as a brief aside here, but it's kind of important. He says pine forests are a primary natural repository of testosterone. And as Diana Beresford Kroger, a great tree steward in the world, says, you walk into a pine forest, you always come out smarter because of the aerosols, right?
That's another part that I really get into is how just figure that because the trees are photosynthesizing, right?
Right.
So they're exuding oxygen constantly, and that provides a hyperbaric atmosphere for us to think more clearly.
Yes. Right. So it's all telling us a story. It's like you want to become less smart, cut down the pine forest. And then what Sean says about testosterone, just as that you can best find in nature in pine bark and pine bark tea. And he says testosterone does not necessarily make people aggressive. It just woofifies whatever social game in which one is enrolled. So if you're engaged in a game that rewards aggression and dominance and cruelty, then you'll be that. And he said, but if you gave pine tea or testosterone to Tibetan Buddhists, they'd be worthier in terms of making peace, right? So it comes back to also what you're suggesting. It's so we want to change the game. What are we rewarding? And then I'll hand it right back to you too, but the book inspires, like, we want to really redefine wealth, right? What is wealth? And culture. What is culture? And that's really, a lot of what you're dedicated to, changing the game redefining.
As an example, most people only think of the forest now as a carbon, sequestering mechanism. But also, the trees are carriers of precipitation. And so my whole idea is that, we can't drink petroleum, right?
Right.
But if we remove the trees, there goes our water. And as I was trying to say, is that's the whole problem of liberal capitalism, is the most essential items, which are the air and the water, have no value on their accounting books.
Yeah, that's right.
And that began, and I have that actually in the British English section. That idea began, 18th century, actually in the 17th century, where, a person asked, what is more profitable, to grow trees and sell them as fuel, or to cut down all the trees and just grow crops? And so no value was, like I say, put on the water that the plants, the trees conserved, or now that we're discovering, actually creating precipitation, which contribute to rivers and the parched mouths.
Yeah, no. It's all crucial, and then in resonance with your saying, China's exporting its deforestation, cutting everything down in Africa. You also have a whole piece on sacrificing American wood to save English forests, right? So it's sneaky that way, right?
Well,
so
actually, one of the parts that I've discovered as I was writing is that the whole story of forests and deforestation created this movement all the way from the Middle East to then to Crete, then to Greece, then to Rome, then to Britain, and each time felling all the trees in those countries, and then to the New World, to America. And then on the East Coast, where from the East Coast to the Mississippi, when the forests were intact, they say a squirrel could walk all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi without touching ground. And then finally, we now are focusing on the Pacific Northwest. And so this is the movement of civilization, all due to forests and deforestation.
Right. And then you say, guide us, America after the revolution, there's a pine tree flag, right? But you say the proclamation of 1763 prohibited white people or, crossing the Appalachians, and the West was to be for native tribes. But you say, this is important, the victory in the Revolutionary War, 260,000 square miles, one massive forest, as you say, no longer off limits, right? So it's like there's some complexity. It's not just American Revolution, rah-rah. It's like, oh no, right, 1763 prohibition for no settlers crossing the Appalachians, that's a good idea. Oh, now it's gone with the victory in the Revolutionary War. That's important to know.
Well, that's a fascinating story, which I cover in also, is that one of the main reasons for going to revolution was to break down that restriction because a lot of the founding fathers had large investments in the great tracts of land west of the Alleghenies, and the only way they could realize their profits was to get the British off their backs.
Right. Yeah. No. There's a lot going.
And it's amazing. What's amazing, because is to think of the Allegheny Mountains, which are the demarcation of the old colonies and the new lands, is that there were like millions of bison running around Pennsylvania, for example. There was elk, all this wildlife that like skedaddled once the peace of 1783 was concluded and the boundaries were broken down. And so you had this mass migration of tree cutters. In fact, I have a picture of, this is really interesting, I have a picture of a lady in the book squatting by all this timber in Minnesota, and one of her relatives today asked, because Minnesota now has very few trees, asked, where did these trees come from?
Right.
So the story of the movement of civilization, and this is what I finally came up with as I was evolving my ideas by studying this whole situation, was that the movement of civilization from east to west can be well explained by the forests and deforestation, loss of woods. For example, in Italy, you had these forests that were forbidden to travel because they were so vast and so big. And a friend of mine who's Italian just laughed because there's nary a tree there now.
Right. Yeah. No. And what you quote somebody in seeing Ohio at first, a grand assemblage of gigantic beings which carried the imagination back to other times before the foot of the white man had touched the American shore. Yeah, and everyone's saying, glorious and amazing. And yeah, and we do want to, we should mention that your book, A Forest Journey, is a beautiful book. Patagonia.
Yeah, isn't it? I just can't believe that it's my book. It's the Patagonia, it's so beautiful.
It is, and not expensive. Everybody really put it in your library everywhere. It's beautiful with photo. It's a beautiful thing. As it should be. It's like, whew, it's something to have as a reference. It's something to read through. It's something to loan to people. It's something to put in libraries. But it's beautiful, and the engravings, the farmers, and the very sad pictures of the great sequoia. The great sequoia, we must get to them before we deconvene. Oh, and John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. Wait, there's much we want to still get to. But the big trees in California, the sequoias, you said were unknown to despoilers until the 1850s. And then
it was sort of exactly like Gilgamesh. That's why I say Gilgamesh is the paradigm for the whole book. In 1853, this a person was tasked to find to get bear for these gold miners, around Yosemite, and suddenly he took a different path, and he saw these huge trees, just like Gilgamesh and his men saw these huge trees, right? And he even reported back to his fellow gold diggers, and they thought he was like on drugs or something, right? And finally, and then when the news spread to the United the rest of the United States, they thought it was a Californian, exaggeration. They
right.
couldn't believe that these giants, and the time scale, right? That one of these sequoias was a sapling during the birth of Aristotle.
Yeah, no, there's a great picture. There's a great picture in the book, A Forest Journey. Everyone to look to that and go to look and weep, but also rededicate, because there's much, and there's much we still have to cover in about a minute. I have former in-laws who are related to Gifford Pinchot, and when going to his estate, it's full of animal trophy heads and everything. But again, complexity. He sours on the timber industry, where we're going in our last moments here, it's very rich. We just want to encourage everybody to explore and be informed, because that's part of being a good citizen. And how do we, what are the qualities of leadership and citizenship, and how do we define wealth and culture? And you say the gods caused Enkidu to come down with a mortal illness, much like COVID-19, right? For 11 days, Enkidu lays.
Exactly. Mm. Well, the gods, while Gilgamesh celebrated, and Enkidu celebrated, the gods convened on what should we do to these miscreants, right, for destroying our world. And they decided, and this really hits, the Semitic culture, that the curse of Humbaba, where Enkidu would be killed, and then Gilgamesh would have nobody to read his funeral oration.
Yeah.
It's sort of like...
That's got to be our exit line, John Perlin. But thank you so much for your prodigious work. Please go, team, to aforestjourney.com. Do check out A Forest Journey, this remarkable book brought back to us and amplified since 1989, A Forest Journey. And yes, and Humbaba's curse that we are living through to become guardians of the forest. Thank you so much, John Perlin.
You're welcome. Can I ask you a question?
Quickly.
Can I get a recording of this?
Yes. We will do that. We will convene backstage, and I will get you a recording of this. Absolutely. Again, thanks again, and we're out of here. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas, one fantastic board op. And we will reconvene next week. CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Thank you. Welcome.